Okay, this hour we're going to take your phone calls with Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, of course, as we talk about parapsychology. I've got a few more questions too, so let's get ready to go when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jeffrey Mishlove with us. Jeffrey, as we were talking about the powers of someone like a Ted Owens, what was he like before he says this UFO experience changed him? Did he go into that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he worked for a while as a research assistant to Dr. J.B. Ryan at Duke University in the parapsychology laboratory. He had been a soldier, or actually a sailor. He was in the Navy, and he got out of the Navy, and he wrote to Dr. Ryan about his own abilities, and Ryan hired him as a research associate, and he enrolled as a student at Duke University. But then, sometime after that, as I recall, he had this strange, uncanny, sort of shamanistic experience where he was driving through the desert in the Southwest in Texas, as I recall, and he had a missing time, and he found himself lying in the desert next to his car, and he was surrounded by a circle of, as he described it, tarantula spiders. And
jeez.
That's when he believed he had been abducted by alien beings, and they, according to him, they had operated on his brain and caused him to have these enormous abilities that subsequently developed.
Did you really have to coax him into being interviewed and studied?
No, he was eager to do that. I first met him because I was visiting my friends Hal Putoff and Russell Targ at SRI International, and he had written to them a letter basically saying, why are you wasting your time with Uri Geller, because I'm the world's most powerful psychic.
Oh, he had an ego, didn't he?
He sure did. And he said, just to prove to you that I am the world's most powerful psychic, I'm going to end the drought that you're now experiencing in California. This was February 1976, as I recall.
All right.
And there was a big drought. And he said, you'll know I did it because there's going to be rain and sleet and hail and the most bizarre weather you've ever had. And there are going to be UFO sightings. And this will all be reported in your local newspaper that the drought has ended as a result of all of this. Well, 3 days later, that happened. And Putoff and Targ wrote back to Ted Owens and basically said that was a wonderful prediction. And he wrote back to them and basically said, prediction? Hell no, I caused it. And at that point, because they were being funded, frankly, by the CIA, we now know. And,
that's right.
And they felt that, you know, they were already engaged in too much controversy with Uri Geller. They couldn't afford to be associated with Ted Owens, whom they regarded as a loose cannon, basically. And here I was, an eager young graduate student studying parapsychology at the time. They basically said, please take this case off of our hands. And they gave me all of their files on him. And so I had all that information, and then I ran into him in London, as I described earlier.
Yeah. Did you two hit it off right away?
Well, we did. And a strange thing happened because, first, as I mentioned earlier, I defended him in front of a hostile audience. And then I was in London, and my girlfriend at the time had given me a little pin to wear while I was traveling, and I thought it was just an image of the planet Saturn with rainbow-colored rings around it. And he saw that pin, and he said, that's the rainbow UFO. He said, that's where my power comes from. And he said, I must have that pin. And I gave it to him, and I guess that sort of forged the bond between us.
Well, good for you. Okay, let's take some calls. Let's go to Glenn driving in Missouri. Welcome to the program. Glenn, you're up with us.
Hey, thanks, George.
Sure thing.
Kind of a vague question here, and it has to do with Geller. I just happened to get home the other day, flipped on the tube, and on PBS there in St. Louis, which you know, George, they had a program on, and it was some magician, Amazing Ernie or whatever. It was like a little 30-minute deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he went and was trying to do like Houdini did and disprove everything that psychokinesis. And he had trained, I guess, two students and he had tricked that institute in California. Are you guys familiar with any of that?
Yeah, and you may be talking about the Amazing Randy.
There you go.
Yeah.
I would just thought maybe you guys could expound on that a little bit because your guest said that he was there in the beginning and seen Geller's abilities in a laboratory. So I thought maybe he would give us some firsthand thoughts about what some of the experiments, because Randy said in that documentary was that he reproduced everything that Geller did.
What do you think of that, Jeffrey? Thanks.
Well, that's a very long story. I have known the Amazing Randy going back to the mid-1970s. We've had various encounters with each other, and I think he does good work in terms of exposing frauds, because there are frauds.
Sure, there are many frauds
in this field, and there have always been. So that's important to do. But he gets carried away. He goes overboard. He seems to be holding the belief or trying to convince people that everything is fraud, that there's nothing but fraud, and that's an error. And now what your caller referred to an incident, Randy called it Project Alpha, where he trained a couple of young magicians to go into a parapsychology laboratory, which was being set up, as I recall, in St. Louis at Washington University, and pretend to have psychokinetic abilities. And the researchers there did some preliminary research without tight experimental controls, and they did not detect the fraud. And Randy sort of trumpeted this as, see how stupid parapsychologists are. And, he devotes his life and he has a following of thousands of people who are like Boy Scouts in trying to suppress anything legitimate in the field, while at the same time occasionally exposing all sorts of fraudulent activity and, I suppose one would have to say, wishy-washy beliefs on the part of many people who are sort of credulous and gullible and willing to believe all sorts of things. So I guess in a nutshell, I would say he throws the baby out with the bathwater.
With all the work that you continue to do in this field, Jeffrey, what's the one thing that you can't explain yet that you would like answered?
Well, for example, there's not one thing. There's actually many things, but one of the best would be the case of Ted Serios, the fellow who did what are called thoughtographs. Anybody who goes to the New Thinking Aloud website will see right at the front an interview I did recently with a professor of philosophy at the University of Maryland, where the Ted Serios archives are now kept in the library there. This fellow was a bellhop in Chicago back in the 1960s and 70s, and he could concentrate on a Polaroid camera, and images would appear on that camera. And some of the most amazing examples are where they would give him a target sealed in an envelope and with aluminum foil, so there's no way you could see into that envelope. And he would have to, his task was to concentrate on the target in the envelope and make an image of that target appear on Polaroid film. And one of the most interesting aspects of that research is how the images that appeared on film were not exact duplicates of the target, but were distorted images of the target in various ways. Now, Randy, the Amazing Randy, has made the claim that he can produce the same effects via trickery, but the truth is that he has not been able to do that. He, under the kind of controlled conditions that went on for years and years by scientists back in the 1960s and 1970s.
Is this field changing? Is it changing dramatically, or is it staying the same?
It's changing, but it's changing slowly. Let me give you an example. My good friend Stephen Schwartz engaged in a series
good guy.
Of studies on psychic archaeology. He's a very good guy. And he took a group of psychics to Egypt, and they went out into the desert and pointed to an area in the sand and said, dig here, and they would uncover significant archaeological finds, and they were able to use their clairvoyant abilities to describe what would be found and how it was used, and very important research that led to very significant discoveries in the area of archaeology. But most of that work was done back in the 1970s and 1980s, and even though Stephen is still around and still available to consult with people, nobody has had the wherewithal subsequently to go out and replicate or expand on those findings. There hasn't been the funding, there haven't been people trained in various disciplines necessary to pursue these sorts of things. So that whole line of research, which was extraordinarily promising, just hasn't gone anywhere since for decades.
How unique would people like you be in this field? I would guess few and far between, right?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm the only person in the world ever to receive an accredited doctoral diploma that says parapsychology on it. To be fair, there are a couple hundred people who have done doctoral research in the field, and their diplomas simply say things like education or psychology or philosophy. But, you know, considering how important this field is in terms of our understanding of human nature, there are very, very few people. It's a very tiny field.
Let's go to Mike in Ohio. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, George. Good morning to your guest.
Hi.
And I had a question about whether someone would have a psychological disorder and if that would be a hindrance or an attribute to, say, the gifts that they had in parapsychology. Say, like, if it was a medium and maybe they were a multiple personality, you know, would that be a hindrance or attribute or any other psychological disorders, and how that would compare to parapsychology, the gifts or talents that a person had?
Okay, interesting question.
Sure thing.
How would that affect that, Jeffrey?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the answer is that, in fact, studies of people who report lots of psychic experiences show a very high percentage of them have experienced trauma in their early childhood, sometimes, you know, serious trauma and abuse. And I suspect that when that happens, it causes these individuals to sort of focus on their inner world, because the outer world is so frightening and difficult to cope with. And as a result of that, they seem more prone to experience a wide range of psychic phenomena, including out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, mediumship, channeling, and a wide variety of spontaneous psychic experiences.
What do you tell people, Jeffrey, who simply don't believe this?
I usually ask them if they're familiar with the literature, and most of them are not. There's 150 years worth of empirical investigation into this field, and often when I run into skeptics, they don't even believe that that's true. They can't imagine that research even exists. There's so much ignorance out there. But to be fair, there are people who have looked at all of that research, and they're still skeptical, but at least they're open-minded skeptics, and I can't ask for anything more than that. If people can form whatever opinions they want about the data, but it's a real shame when people deny that the data even exists.
Let's go to Irene in Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Irene. Go ahead.
Yes. Perhaps you can help me remember this gentleman's name. I was listening to talk radio in a prop. It was approximately, well, 1967, and he claimed that he could come through the phone, tell you what you were wearing, what disease you had. People were calling, and they were amazed that he knew what they were wearing and they didn't know their diseases. But he also claimed that he would stop the clocks at a certain time. And I still remember, I was thinking, I'm not calling him. I haven't finished cleaning the kitchen today.
Huh. Would that have been Uri Geller?
It might have. I don't know. It was in the 60s, around 67. And thousands of people after the program were calling and said, were saying and claiming that their clocks actually stopped.
Well, he would be about 21 years old or something at that time, Jeffrey. Would he not be?
Yeah, in the United States, Uri Geller's career began in about 1972, but clocks stopping, actually, more likely clocks
starting.
People reported that they had broken watches and broken clocks, and they would start.
Yep, he did that on our program, and it worked, and then we re-ran the show a year later, and all of a sudden I'm getting emails from people saying, my watch is starting again, my clocks are working, and it dawned on me, oh my God, they're listening to that, you know, that segment with Uri Geller.
Somebody should do a sociological study about the kinds of effects like that result from your program, George.
That's not a bad idea at all. Jeffrey, we're going to take a break pretty soon and come back with final questions for you. But for people, again, who want to watch your YouTube channel, tell us what they do.
Go, simply type in New Thinking Aloud, A-L-L-O-W-E-D, all one word, newthinkingaloud.com, and you'll be there.
And can we still get the book, The PK Man?
The PK Man is available on Amazon and elsewhere, yes.
A great book about Ted Owens. And do you miss him?
Yes, I miss not having people around like him who can produce demonstrations one after another after another. It would be such a boon to researchers. During his lifetime, I tried so hard to interest other scientists in what he was doing. At one point, I even virtually kidnapped the famous UFO researcher, J. Allen Hynek.
Oh, sure, yeah.
To a meeting to talk about Ted Owens. And when he got there, basically he said, I wouldn't go near him with a 10-foot pole.
It was his attitude, was it not?
Well, he felt that this is a phenomenon produced by the unconscious mind, and it couldn't be controlled or studied scientifically.
Well, that's an interesting take. All right, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take final phone calls. Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove with us, and you on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Jeffrey Mishlove with us, of course, in your final phone calls as we talk about parapsychology. Jeffrey, did you ever read the book Breakthrough to Creativity? It was by my aunt, Shafika Karegula.
Well, indeed I did. In fact, I invited her to come and speak at a symposium at the University of California when I was a student.
Ooh, did she show up?
She sure did.
Yeah, she was something else. She devoted her entire psychiatric practice to studying telepathy, telekinesis, all this. She was just into it in a big way.
And her book still is, in my mind, a classic.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, there weren't a lot of doctors who stuck their neck out like she did back in the 60s.
That's right. What impressed me a lot about that book is a case she reported, one of her clients who kept having dreams about going into a dream school and being taught all sorts of esoteric knowledge. And on one occasion, she remembered another man who was in the same like dream classroom with her and was actually eventually able to find that person, and he was having the same dream.
Yeah, that's remarkable. And she died in a very bizarre way, Jeffrey. A radio fell into a tub that she was in. She got electrocuted.
Oh, my.
Thank God she wasn't listening to Coast to Coast at the time. Jesus. My gosh. Okay, let's go back to the calls. Gary in Santa Maria is with us. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Thank you, George. Sure. 13 years waiting for this phone call.
Yes, sir.
Jeff, I was in your group on a redundant pre-stimulus response back in 2003, May 4th, 2003. And it took quite a bit of digging, and I found out that I was in the top 3% of the 125 people that were tested, that was out by Los Feliz.
I remember that. Yeah,
that with James Spottiswood.
Yes.
Yeah. And that set me on a whole new career path. I kind of quit my day job of programming artificially intelligent systems and focused on PK Man. Like scenarios, but I was blending it into astrology that I adapted to artificial intelligence because the two go hand in hand and glove perfectly. And then most recently, and the most astounding thing, are the 10 different tests that I've done on coast-to-coast experiments, of which George kind of started getting his patients running a little short with me because I kept going back to the same topic, and that is taking my favorite punching bag genetic engineering company that I won't name and asking the audience to think their stock price going down. Well, 10 times out of 10 times, it went down. You're into stock predictions and market predictions. The difference that George and I have, and I hope you can weigh in on this, is when you talk about thought control, not mind control, thought control, if I try to control your thoughts, there's only a 1 out of 538 possibility that I will chime in at your exact octave or frequency. But when you have an audience the size of Coast, 538 people will cover practically the entire population. So when you put out the vague notion of stock price going down, and you have a number of people concentrating on that, you chime in on those day traders. You chime in on the people responsible for the decisions. They don't even know it's not their thought. The thought comes from within them, but they end up selling the package. It's right there out in public. I wanted to do what Owen did, but make it so public. Every time that I was on the air, it's recorded. You go and you take a two-year view of that genetic engineering company that's easy to find, compare it with the stock market price, put it on a two-year view, and you will see stair step after stair step, down, 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 down. It went from $125 a share all the way down to 83 at the lowest point, and now it's languishing about 90, which is fine by me. Thought control, mass consciousness can work.
Well, isn't that what Ted Owens did, basically, Jeffrey? Thought control?
Well, he never worked on the stock market.
No, he didn't. He didn't do that, of course.
No, so this is quite different, and I guess all of this began with the experiment you participated in back in 2004. Is that right?
Yes, it all stemmed from that. And in fact, I got on the bad side of Spottiswood because they sent us our individual results. Everybody was assigned a number to keep the double-blind nature, which was important to Spottiswood. Yeah. And I kept pressing to find out how I did in comparison to everybody else, and I finally got through and got the final results. Now, I think those results have got to be around someplace. It was keyed off of email, but Spottiswood was... Is Spottiswood still alive? His website hasn't been updated in a decade.
Yeah, no, he is. He's alive and he's active.
Well, he may remember. I wouldn't even know... I would recognize the name of the provider I was using. That was in the 5600 baud days, by the way, 2003. But I, in keeping with your profile, I had my first major left frontal lobe brain trauma at age 7, again at age 18, and again at age 42, all on the same side, really debilitating brain injury, all to the left frontal lobe. Each time that I recovered, even worked with Timothy Leary up in Berkeley for a while. But it was because of that one experiment where I categorically, came out to be one of the three superstars of that experiment that really put me on track to working with this. And then with George's help and the Coast audience, and witches have done the same thing where they cast a spell and causes something to happen. It's not woo-woo. It's just coming in at somebody's exact frequency. You got to take the sun sign, the rising sign, and the moon sign. That's 1,728 possibilities. That's it.
Well,
that's fascinating.
It is. It works, doesn't it, Jeffrey?
It sounds like this individual has the potential to participate in some very serious research.
I think so, too. Todd's in Rochester, New York now. Go ahead, Todd. Well, Todd is no longer in Rochester, New York. Let's go to Loretta in Modesto, California. Hi, Loretta.
Good morning, sir. Back in the 60s and 70s, what you guys spoke a moment ago about the gentleman,
mm-hmm.
He was great. It was fun listening to that. I barely remember it, but yes. Now, the true reason I called was because of this blackout I have. Doctors, lawyers, everyone, even military, says to put on. Could this possibly be something like that?
What kind of blackout did you have?
The longest I've ever had was while I was out mentally, but not physically, for 2.5 months.
2.5 months?
Yes, sir.
Jeez.
Took care of my kids, paid my bills. Even wrote checks and even saw a neuropsychologist. He didn't even know I was out. There is this kind of a thing. I've been trying to prove this ever since in the 50s. While I was in military, I came down with it. Nobody
But you functioned. You carried on.
This one kind, I can't, yes.
But you didn't know what you were, you can't remember any of it?
I don't remember a bit of it. Not a bit.
What happened to her, Jeffrey?
Well, I suppose the psychiatric term would be disassociation. However, I would really need to talk to her in greater detail to understand.
I think so,
it.
Too. That's weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a case of amnesia or something.
Yeah.
Jeff in Culver City, California. Hey, Jeffrey, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, George and Mr. Mishlove. Yes, I once read this book entitled The Elusive Quarry by Ray Hyman. I also listened to a song by the late jazz artist Gil Scott-Heron mentioning that he's almost touching something on the other side. When researching or actually performing functions related to the paranormal or parapsychological fields, it's like touching a soap bubble. If you touch it ever so gently, the bubble will remain a bubble. But if you poke it hard enough, it will burst and disappear. People who have these gifts of telekinesis, clairvoyancy, remote viewing, and precognition are like that bubble. My question is this, Mr. Mishlove, why are this elusive gift, in your opinion, only given to certain chosen individuals? And I'm sure for many of these people, they're wondering, what's in it for them personally? Seeing an earthquake, for example, precognitively in a foreign land, before it happens, or a coup in a neighboring country, what good is it to have this gift when there's nothing to be gained from it personally for the individual who possessed the gift? And I'll take your answer up there.
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you for that question. And the book by Ray Hyman, The Elusive Quarry, is an old book, but it's a good one. Ray Hyman was a skeptic, but he actually included a section in that book in which I interviewed him, and he admitted, skeptic that he was, that the research in parapsychology is far better than the skeptics really appreciate. Now, as to your question, what good is it? It's very frustrating for many people who have these abilities because we don't have a culture that supports them. If we had a supportive culture, we could harness these abilities for the betterment of humanity, probably in hundreds of different ways. But it requires a supportive family, a supportive community, and researchers willing to step in and assist in these sorts of things. I imagine that someday in the future we will have a society that recognizes these abilities and assists people, just as we do with people who show mathematical talent or musical talent or athletic talent. But until that happens, it's a very lonely world for gifted people.
Let's go to Ryan in Michigan. First time caller. Ryan, thank you. Good morning, and you're up.
Hi, George.
Hi there.
Good. I guess my question is for Jeffrey is how his thoughts are on how we all have had these abilities in the past, maybe when humanity first started, and that we lost them and we're slowly gaining them back, because it seems like we're headed towards spiritualism. But, you know, there's also that materialism trying to destroy that. And, like, do you think that spiritual beings work through people like Tesla said, that, you know, he got thoughts, his ideas, you know, Napoleon and Leonardo da Vinci?
Well, but you've raised a number of fascinating questions. One is the spiritual and psychic phenomenon, how does that relate to human genius? And I do think there is a relationship there. And the first part of your question had to do with, again, you know, what will society be like, if I understood your question correctly. And I do think that these abilities have always existed. In fact, in most of the world, if you go to Africa, or if you go to South America, or if you go to Asia, people accept these abilities as pretty normal. It's generally in the United States and in mostly in the United States.
Well, what happened? Lost knowledge. How did it fade away?
Well, it's because back in the 17th century or so, science realized it had to break free from the yoke of the Christian church that was suppressing science and, for example, imprisoning researchers like Galileo. And so anything having to do with religion became sort of forbidden in science. And that enabled science to make many great strides forward. But in so doing, I think the whole scientific community threw out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah, they sure did. Let's go to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Bobby. Take it away.
Hi.
Hey, Bobby.
Great show.
Thanks.
I just lost my sister, my twin sister, like two weeks ago.
Sorry to hear that.
And horrible, but I've had these strange dreams and stuff about her, and I feel like she's like here with me. And but I also feel, you know, I believe in UFOs, and I believe, like, the universe, like, too big to explain. But I'm just, like, curious, because I really believe now that that she's not gone to another place, that she's here with us, that she's stayed here. But I don't know why I believe that. I just know that she's here, and she's, like, trying to help us.
Well, you're a believer in the afterlife, Bobby, and you know, was someone like Ted Owens, Jeffrey, a believer in that too?
I think he was, and there's a lot of scientific research. The whole field of psychical research began in the 1850s as an effort to determine whether there was an afterlife and could we study it scientifically. And there's a great deal of very significant data that suggests that people do continue on after the physical body passes away, that the consciousness does survive. In fact, I have an interview scheduled for tomorrow with a researcher who has investigated a case where a deceased chess master came back and through an automatic writing medium actually played a game of chess with Viktor Korchnoi, who was
really that's cool.
Yeah, grandmaster in chess, and was able to play a game at that level.
I would love to have something like that happen to me, where I get possessed just for a moment to play chess like that.
Yeah, it's quite a story and a very well-documented case.
Jeffrey, I only have about a minute left, and I want to just review a few things that you've been working on. Again, your YouTube channel is available to people under New Thinking Aloud, and I assume at your website you've got links there too?
Yes.
Perfect.
All kinds of links.
What's your next project?
Well, I plan to continue doing these videos for as long as I'm able to do it, George. I'm 69 years old now, but I think I can go for at least another 10 years. And I hope to be able to do video interviews with all of the important senior people in parapsychology during that time.
Well, my friend, you take care. Keep in touch with us, Jeffrey. Thanks again for being on our Beyond Belief TV show with me, too.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Jeffrey Mishlov, and again, you've got to read the book, The PK Man, The Story of Ted Owens. It's an amazing story of the things that Ted did to get recognition. I mean, he really did everything he could to create, believe it or not, catastrophes, so he would get credit for it. I mean, but that was his way of trying to wake everybody up. Truly a remarkable, remarkable guy. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.